Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the dollar value of a human life and how it plays into what we're willing to do to get COVID-19 under control. We'll spend this hour with Wired Magazine senior correspondent Adam Rogers. He'll explain how statisticians calculate how much money it's worth to the government to prevent one premature death. And we'll also talk about the accounting for the real and measurable economic distress caused by virus-related closures, event cancellations, and new rules for businesses. Our conversation starts after a short break. Your life is worth approximately $10 million. Let me rephrase that. If some new government policy to preserve your life or anyone else's costs less than that, it's considered economically justifiable. If it is more than $10 million per life saved, the program probably won't happen. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So we wondered, how does the math work on all we've done to bring COVID-19 under control? Tens of thousands of jobs lost, billions upon billions of investment value evaporated, nearly 100,000 Americans dead. Crass as it may seem, these numbers are all related to one another. And understanding those relationships may offer insight into how we need to proceed from here. Adam Rogers is here to walk us through this. He is senior correspondent at Wired, where you can read his recent article, How Much is a Human Life Actually Worth? Adam, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Hi. Nice to talk to you.
I think most people can agree that putting a dollar value on human life is problematic for a wide variety of reasons, no matter how much thought and care go into the equation. How did such a thing become necessary in the first place?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. People immediately get really skeezed out by the idea, reasonably so. And I always feel like when I've talked about this story to other folks, friends and family, to say like, it's not me. I didn't do it. Please don't blame me. But people do anyway, which is fine. right. So why would you do this? Well, some of the answer goes back to the beginning of insurance, you know, when you're trying to spread out the risk that people take on products or goods or services or anything that involves people doing stuff. And you don't want the entire amount of risk to fall on any one person. You want to understand how much to pay somebody in life insurance, for example. So actuarial calculations have been made for centuries almost. But the beginning of this for trying to make policies, to make government scale decisions or military scale decisions, really started in the Cold War, primarily with a group called RAND, which started out as a U.S. Air Force funded think tank and then went independent. And in about 1949, the Air Force went back to RAND and said, can you help us figure out how to most cost effectively nuke the Soviet Union in a first strike? Because we have a limited number of airplanes and a limited number of missiles. So that's an astonishing thing to ask about, right? But it was the beginning of using tools like game theory and digital computers to try to understand military strategy. And what RAND went away and ran a bunch of simulations and started using computers, one of the first uses of digital computers, and came back and said, what you should do is just blanket the sky with cheap airplanes so that the Soviets don't know which ones are carrying the nuclear weapons. They don't know who to shoot down. And that way, you know, your first strike is likely to be effective. And the Air Force came back and said, we don't want to do that because that kills a lot of pilots, and it's really expensive to kill pilots. And also they wouldn't get to buy new jet airplanes because they were saying use propeller planes. So RAND went away and said like, okay, got it. We're the contractor. We'll take that on board. They went away, but they realized that a thing that they didn't know in their calculations was, well, how much are those pilots worth in a sense? These highly trained, you know, the military spends a lot of money training these folks. It's a life. How much is that worth? And so they started thinking about that problem in a way that was much more granular and accounting like, and tried to figure out the apples to apples comparison of, we're going to spend a certain amount of money and we want to know if it's worth spending that money to save these pilots, to keep these pilots safe as they fly or in case they will be lost. So they started doing calculations on things like, well, how much are we training them? When do we tell a pilot to eject and lose an airplane versus try to bring a damaged airplane back because the airplane has a cost and the pilot training has a cost? Or how much should we spend to build an ejection pod for a big bomber, you know, which will save pilots, but it'll cost a lot of money to build and it adds a lot of cost to the airplane. Running all these kind of numbers started the thought process in trying to understand how to put value toward a life. And obviously this was all really controversial for all the reasons you said at the top. It has moral implications. It has philosophical implications to say that a life, a given life, a person you might know, your relative, your partner, you know, your child, has a dollar value. And we never want to think about things that way. But as soon as you're talking about a lot of people over a population, you're talking about spending millions or billions of dollars, then people start to, candidly, they start to ask those questions. So that's where this started, in sort of the late 40s and early 50s, with military thinking.
And courts have also looked to estimate the value of human life to assess damages in wrongful death lawsuits. They talked for a while about sort of lost lifetime earning potential, but that never quite worked for anybody. Why not?
Yeah, that's a really important point to make, too, is that there was this whole other strain of trying to figure this out when somebody would die in an accident on the job and their family would sue the company they were working for, and the court would try to figure out, well, how much should we give that family? And the answer for a while, and everybody knew it was a bad answer even then, was, well, how much was that person going to earn over their lifetime if they hadn't died? You know, in the counterfactual alternate history, they don't die in the mine cave-in or whatever. So how much, what salary would they have earned? We'll give the family that. But of course, you immediately see the problem there, which is like, well, in this mine accident that I just made up, and I don't mean to be flip about this, I'm sorry, it's hard to talk about this kind of thing, you know, to give it the weight that it deserves.
But I get it.
In this mine accident that I just made up, if one of the miners dies, but also one of the people who works in the office dies, the person working in the office presumably was making more money. Does that family deserve more money somehow? Is the fact that the person through either diligent effort or accident of fate has a higher salary, does that mean that they're worth, again, in scare quotation marks, worth more money? So immediately people knew, well, that's not right. And you can even make the case, as some people have tried, that in fact, what you can value a person based on how much money they were going to spend, like how much were they going to contribute to the economy, which is a really, you know, kind of cold-hearted capitalist way to think about it, but also has the problem of, well, what if a person's a spendthrift, or what if a person makes more money and is completely profligate with their spending? That doesn't mean that if they die, that their life was somehow worth equivalent to that. So obviously there's a problem there. You know, it just doesn't map out philosophically or economically.
All right. So who's Kip Viscusi?
Right. So here's what happened. So then in all of this military thinking, a former Air Force pilot who went on to get his PhD, named Jack Carlson, comes up with a way out of all this. He says, well, maybe instead of trying to put a cost on a life, on how much a person's life is worth, maybe what we're actually talking about is how much it's worth to save that life. And he was looking at ejection, what I was talking about before, about ejecting from a damaged plane or building this $80 million ejection pod for the B-58. And he does the math and he figures out that the Air Force is already making this calculation. They're already doing something that he called the money valuation of pilots' lives. And he says that the Air Force essentially says a pilot's life is worth between about $1.2 million and $9 million. And his thesis advisor, then, who had worked for Rand and named Thomas Schelling, he'd go on to win the Nobel Prize for game theory in nuclear war. But at the time when he was at Harvard, he then goes and writes a chapter for a book. He does a presentation called The Life You Save May Be Your Own. And what he figures out is he sort of takes Carlson's idea and extends it even farther. And he says, what you can do is figure out how much people in a group, you know, a few thousand people are willing to either to pay to not take a risk or to take money for taking that risk, hazard pay kind of stuff. And then you sort of average that out over the entire group. And you say, well, this is how much, because economists like to think in terms of something called revealed preference. Don't you know, use policy to tell people what to do. We just want to know what people do in their daily lives, and that tells us something about what they value and what they don't. And he said, you can find through surveys and revealed preference, you can figure out that at the time, people are basically willing to spend $3 million to save a life. And so he said that's the revealed preference. And it's Schelling who called it the value of a statistical life. So it's not the value of an individual life, but statistical life smeared out the same way insurance tries to smear out the average across things. And it gets him out. It gets everybody out from under the moral rock of, are we saying that a life has a dollar value? Saying no. We're saying that all of us think that saving lives has this value. He came up with $3 million. If you figure out the calculation and then figure out inflation, it ends up being about what the number is today, between $9 and $11 million. And so then, he figures that out. That becomes a concept in economics. And then in about the 1970s, Jimmy Carter and then Ronald Reagan as president both start to worry about regulation and the cost of regulations, because the economy's in the doldrums, and Reagan had a huge deregulation approach to government in general. So they say, well, okay, we want all of every new regulation has to go through what's called a cost-benefit analysis. We're going to try to assess whether the cost of instituting any new regulation either outweighs or doesn't outweigh the benefits you get from doing it. This is a practice used across government and industry, cost-benefit analysis. Sometimes they call it benefit-cost analysis for reasons that, as far as I can tell, are completely arbitrary and I have not yet understood. And so in 1981, Kip Viscusi, who's an economist, says, okay, at the Office of Management and Budget, which is doing these cost-benefit evaluations, let's use VSL, value of a statistical life, to make those decisions. And he's the one who figures out that there's $3 million valuation then, which ends up being about $10 million now. And this is the approach that, you know, we can argue, again, the philosophy and ethics of this, but this is the approach that when government is making decisions, like, should we rebuild a highway guide rail, or should we, you know, change the rules on how much a factory is allowed to emit, or should we change the rules on how much a local fishery is allowed to take in a given season? That this is how they do it. This is what they're balancing stuff against. Does the cost outweigh the benefit, or the benefit outweigh the cost? And if it's involved saving a life, or if there are health or potential public health consequences, this is the decision-making practice they're supposed to use.
Okay, my guest is Adam Rogers. He's a senior correspondent at Wired. All right, his article in Wired is called How Much is a Human Life Actually Worth? Adam, how do we measure risks from less immediate threats to life, like water or air pollution? Presumably, they might shorten someone's life. They're not necessarily kind of an immediate life or death thing.
Yeah, and this is when it gets... this is when this all gets much more complicated. You actually want to use something like VSL for those kind of distant and small risks to an individual, for the things that you and I would say, that's a very distant risk to me, whether there's a little bit more aerosol particulates in the air from brake dust in cars, or mm-hmm. whether there's slightly more of a given chemical with an unknown and small risk increasing possibility in the water. Those are things that don't affect an individual particularly, but if you do the large scale population wide public health calculation, you can say, oh, this is going to cost some number of years off of people's lives overall. And then the cost benefit actually gets easier, because people aren't as scared of it, and the risk is distant, and it's sort of a clear risk for a population, a small risk for an individual. Those are the kind of circumstances when these cost-benefit analyses and VSL is actually really helpful. It's only when you start to get risks that are much more significant to an individual, or not as well understood, like COVID-19, that it's harder to make these calculations. And I will say too, there are some things that we don't actually do these numbers honestly for. And those are the conditions that overlap with public health that make the COVID-19 thing even more difficult.
All right. We'll talk about all of this in just a moment with my guest, Adam Rogers, who is senior correspondent at Wired. He recently wrote a piece called How Much is a Human Life Actually Worth? This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Wired senior correspondent Adam Rogers. His recent article is called How Much is a Human Life Actually Worth? So, of course, Adam, the value of a statistical life is playing into some of the decisions governments are making about restrictions related to COVID-19. If the 99,000 odd American lives we've lost already are worth $10 million apiece, I mean, by my calculations, that's $990 trillion of value loss, but it doesn't quite work that way.
It doesn't quite work that way. And I should say two things about this before I'll try to do a little of the math, but I'll say two things. First of all, it is super unclear whether any of the decisions that at any level of government that are being made about how to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic are actually using strict cost-benefit analyses. They haven't made that clear at all. I mean, certainly that messaging has not come at the federal level, and public health measures are actually controlled at the local and state levels, and states are all making different kinds of decisions. It's possible, by implication, you could say, well, maybe what they mean when they say we're letting governors decide and it has to vary from locality to locality, maybe that's what they mean, but there's no indication that they're actually doing this in a rigorous way. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, and this is a really, this is a common thing that people do when they think about this, is we think, are we supposed to be calculating value of the people who've died? The nearly 100,000 people who've died of this disease so far. But really what you're supposed to do here is figure out how many lives have we saved. That's the benefit. You're supposed to be able to go, well, okay, if we've, and the president has said this too, that he's made claims that various things have happened could have been as high as 2.2 million at one point. So you could calculate it's about 1 million people whose lives have been saved is what epidemiologists will say. So I did find one group of researchers that attempted to do this math explicitly from the University of Wyoming. They had a paper in the Journal of Benefit Cost Analysis, which is a thing. By their assessments, they used gross domestic product. They used GDP as the value on the side of what you would lose. And they said that under other conditions, GDP would have shrunk by $6.5 trillion over this time period. But in fact, it'll probably drop because of these non-pharmaceutical interventions, because of things like social distancing and stay-at-home orders, shelter in place, no restaurants and business have to close, no big events, that it'll actually drop. GDP will drop by $13.7 trillion, they said. So you do the math there and you say, well, the cost of all of these measures has been $7.2 trillion. But they said all of these measures will save, their estimate was 1.2 million lives. And so that's where you apply BSL. You apply the value of those statistical lives, and you get a 10 million pop, and you get a benefit of $12.4 trillion. So you say, well, okay, then all of these measures, these non-pharmaceutical interventions to fight COVID-19, save $5.2 trillion. We'll save $5.2 trillion. So that's a win. You say, well, there you go. Clearly, over the entire country, then that wins out. And I actually, I went, this is in the story, but I asked Kip Viscusi, who's still working, he's at Vanderbilt University. I asked him how he felt about that. And he sort of, went over, did the math too. And he said roughly you save 1 million lives, 10 million each, $10 trillion, half the GDP. So it's worth it. He said benefits of social distancing swamp the costs. But of course it's way more complicated than that, right? I mean, immediately you can see problems on both the cost side and the benefit side of that equation.
Well, sure, because if you use GDP to measure how well we're doing dealing with COVID-19, we know that prevention efforts have had an effect on the economy. It's also true that GDP might conceivably rise if we just keep everybody going back to work, regardless of whether it's safe. And those risks seem to fall disproportionately to lower income folks.
Right, for sure. So everybody, as soon as you do this kind of math, every economist, including the people who do this use GDP for a living, will say, of course, we all know GDP is a terrible measure for the economy. As one of them said to me, if everybody's so scared that they all buy bars for their windows, that makes GDP go up. So clearly there's something wrong with the metric there. And as you say, all of these, you begin to have to ask who is incurring the costs and who is getting the benefits. So if the benefits are, well, large corporations get to stay in business, the airlines stay in business, but the costs are that people who don't have any other recourse have to go to work in frontline jobs, in essential jobs, and jobs that where if they don't go to work, they lose their house or their family doesn't have enough to eat, but they risk getting the disease. Well, they're incurring a cost very different than a societal cost, than a decline in GDP. So there are issues with how you account for those for the economy, these various different scales of how to think about the economy. And then on the other side, it'll look like, from the perspective of calculating VSL, it looks like a revealed preference that, like, oh, well, people want to go back to work. They want to get back on modes of commuting to the office that, or to the, you know, to the meatpacking plant floor that expose them to a lot of people, and they want to be in a place that's risky, and they're willing to accept the amount of money that they're getting. But in fact, if they had unemployment benefits that meant that they didn't have to do that, they wouldn't. So it's unclear how revealed. No, it's clear how revealed the preference is. It's unclear how much of a preference it is, and how much of a mandate it is. And that, as you say, that weight falls disproportionately on, as we're seeing in this pandemic, on poorer people, on people working class and below, and especially relatedly on people of color.
And why is the value of a statistical life a less useful tool, relatively speaking, when we're factoring in the effect of a policy on many thousands of lives, rather than we're looking at just a handful of people, as in your earlier example of the number of pilots in a given year who might need to eject from an expensive jet?
Yeah, it's not. Some economists who study it think that it's not a tool that's designed to look at that large a population. The numbers get too big, that it doesn't make sense because you're averaging out over everybody, but there are outliers in every possible respect. There are people who are going to suffer disproportionately. There are people who don't understand the risks. Nobody fully understands the risks of COVID-19 because the epidemiology and immunology, the infectious disease science is still getting done. That's in economic terms, that's called Knightian uncertainty when you don't know what the risk is that you're trying to plan against, in the case of VSL. And that's a factor here as well. There's no way to reveal a preference. There's no way to do these calculations. And also the risk is greater. It's not a small risk spread out among a lot of people. It's effectively a large risk. And I'm sure you've read the ongoing questions about what's the infection fatality rate of COVID-19, which is to say who gets sick. Of the people who get sick, who get infected with it, how many of them die? And there are the numbers vary anywhere from, you know, 1% to 4% in places where, then you start to see what's called spatiotemporal heterogeneity, which just means in different places at different times, it's different. So in New York City, that's been very, very high. Of course, we might not even know because there isn't enough testing done to know how many people actually are infected. But let's put that aside for a second. Some places that the number is lower, and it's also higher for different demographic groups. So, so far, this has been a disease that when older people get sick with it, they are much more likely to die than younger people or even people middle-aged. That's changing as the disease moves to different places, different populations around the country and around the world. But what that means is the entire population is calculating a VSL for the entire population when, in fact, certain groups in the population are at much more risk because of something that they do in their jobs or because of just who they are, because of a physiological or, you know, an age factor. And the age thing is a whole other issue with VSL that becomes much more complicated because it's unclear. It has been unclear how to, or whether you should change the VSL calculation for older people. That's been very controversial in the past. And there's been a weird flip politically here because in past times when people would argue there should be something called a senior death discount, which would say we should calculate the VSL lower for people who are older, nominally because it may be that they would say, well, they have less to live for isn't the right way to say this, but that they have fewer years and so they're willing to incur less of a risk because it's not worth it. Of course, you could also say maybe every moment for them is precious and so they it's more valuable to them. But as soon as policymakers would try to do that, it was sort of career-wise very dangerous for that because people didn't want to say, "What, you're telling me that my grandmother has a lower value than I do?" This was the same argument, let's say a related argument too, if you remember the death panels thing about healthcare, where people were saying, "Oh, well, you can't decide who gets what therapy based on how old they are. If it's not worth it to give it to them in some way, that's horrifying. These are death panels that we're putting into healthcare, and we can't have that." really is some of the same people who made the arguments against, called these ideas of triaging or how to apportion healthcare, who were vehemently against the notion of a senior death discount, who are now essentially saying older people should risk their lives for the economy to come back. That's part of the sacrifice they make. It's really flipped, and you see in that kind of inversion just how political these nominally cold equations can become.
Well, let's step back here for a minute, because presumably we're talking about there are certain models that are created and calculated for the benefit of epidemiologists. There are models made by and for economists. There are people talking about, the need to perhaps have more interdisciplinary modeling. What are the pros and cons of epidemiological models as compared with econometric models?
Yeah, there's very much of a near the twain shall meet issue here, some siloization among the research and academic communities. We've all been watching the way epidemiologic models have been used or haven't been used, have been misunderstood and haven't been right about the progress of the pandemic. And it's a very hard problem. This is something that epidemiologists have been doing for much of the 20th century, and it is a difficult thing, even taking aside the economics for a moment, in part because if they get it right and people change their behavior because they're scared of something that's going to happen, then it looks like they got it wrong, but also because they often get it wrong, because it's really hard to predict the future. And the ways that the epidemiologic models have worked in the past, there are a whole bunch of different versions and subspecies and categories of all of these. But the broad strokes here make it very hard for them to incorporate change in the way people are behaving in those models. They're really based on the data of how the disease behaves in populations. So the models have not been great at telling the difference between the way the disease will behave in one place or at one time versus another. And they have not been great at incorporating the changes that occur if you have social distancing measures in place versus if you don't. And there are a bunch of different models now, and they all attempt to address these problems in different ways.
Go ahead, please continue.
Well, sorry, I was going to say the econometric models try to account for that behavior in everything that they do, the way that people's behavior will change in response to different policy changes and social changes, but they're not as good at accounting for how a disease is going to spread through a population. And so right now people are trying to work on bringing those two things together.
Have the models told us anything useful about the timing of things like social distancing measures and how the timing of the onset of those measures has played into the spread of the infection?
Yeah, and that's the kind of work. A lot of that work is going on right now, especially among the economists who are getting more and more interested in this. A lot of the social distancing measures that got put into place did rely on kind of sort of trying to put economics into the epidemiologic models. In a way, the idea of the reproductive number, which may be a term that folks have heard, but it's the number that says if somebody is infected, how many other people does that person infect? And if it's below one, then that means the disease is going to go away. And if it's higher and higher, that means it's spreading faster and faster. Social distancing measures, stay-at-home orders, are a blunt way of tamping down that number, R. It's called R0, depending on how you do the numbers. So in a way, you're building social distancing into a model if you tweak that R value, because it's not really known yet epidemiologically. That's one of the things people are trying to calculate. But there also have been some pretty good studies talking about the consequences of the social distancing measures that got put in sort of haphazardly in the United States in different cities in response to the 1918 flu pandemic. Different cities had different levels of measures. In San Francisco, here in the Bay Area, there were actually anti-mask leagues, just like people are doing now. People had huge protests against wearing masks, and there were arrests and things like that. So time is a flat circle, as they say. But at the time, if you go back and do this math, and this is done by some of the same people who are doing models now, like at Harvard and elsewhere, the cities that instituted social distancing measures sooner and more intensely, so more severe social distancing, actually recovered economically more quickly and had a higher bounce after the pandemic had waned. And that study was tremendously influential when people were first initiating these measures. What the modelers now go back and show, epidemiologic models have been warning that if you lift social distancing too soon, you see the second wave. Among the phrases that all have learned along with flattening the curve that we're talking about is how many cases there are over how much time. And then the second wave is, well, they come back. If you don't reduce R enough, if you don't reduce the cases enough, and if you don't institute all the other things that you're supposed to do, like testing and contact tracing, and ideally the kind of economic supports that people can have so that they can stay home instead of going back to work too soon.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go to the phones. We have Annie calling us from Irving, Texas. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. So the question I have is, how can there be a cost-benefit analysis focused on the number of lives saved without widespread testing?
Thanks for calling.
Well, that's like the most trenchant question that everyone should be asking loudly. We're trying to do this math without a denominator, without knowing what the number on the bottom of the fraction is. Nobody knows how many people are actually infected. And this is a question for, this is an important question for a lot of reasons. One of them is, it does seem clear, though nobody knows the extent of this, that asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic transmission is a huge factor in spreading the disease, which is to say people who don't know they're sick yet, who aren't showing any symptoms of being sick, are infected with the virus and can give it to other people. Nobody knows how many of them there are. Nobody knows how often that happens. I mean, I've seen ranges, one of the calculation put it as much as 86% of infections. It doesn't seem that big. And that number has become political as well, because if the number is very, very big, that suggests that a lot more people than we know got this disease. It wasn't serious, got sick, are immune to it now because they've been infected and they recovered. And it does seem like this sort of viral infection that if you get it once, you are immune to it for some long period of time. That's what the science is showing. Hard to know for sure because this disease has only been in people for a few months, but that's something that you don't know as well. So yes, what you absolutely need to know to do this kind of math fairly is how many people are sick and or how many people have been infected, and nobody knows the answer.
Adam Rogers is senior correspondent at Wired. You can read his article, How Much is a Human Life Actually Worth? This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Adam Rogers. He is senior correspondent at Wired, which recently published his article, How Much is a Human Life Actually Worth? We hear from Carol, who wonders, Adam, if the value of a statistical life takes into account how much it costs to save that life. For example, how much medical care would be required to prevent someone from dying from COVID-19 or any other disease?
Yeah, it's supposed to build in, as I understand it, that's a very good question, and it gets at how complicated all this is. It's supposed to build in, that would be in the costs side of how much people are willing to spend for a life. I will say, among the other ways that you can try to do this math, in the National Health Service in the United Kingdom, they use a standard called quality-adjusted life years, or QALYs, Q-A-L-Ys, which, if they're trying to assess a drug, they try to say, well, how good is the extra life that we're giving somebody going to be, you know, the difference between being, if you're going to spend a lot of money and the person's going to be in bed, bedridden, you know, on machinery for a year, is that better than they would have been otherwise, even if they survived for longer? That's less used. That's used in healthcare pretty widely, but not as a, not in a federal government level in the US for cost benefit.
Okay, so 2.5 months into national efforts to mitigate the effects of this virus, we have just about every state opening up fully or at least partially. Do we know anything about which interventions seem to have the most impact in terms of reducing risk?
Yeah, but it's incomplete knowledge. Mm-hmm. One of the things, I'm actually writing about this today. Oh. In fact, one of the things that's going on right now is trying to understand of the three modes of transmission that respiratory diseases often have, diseases like the flu, for example, have this as well, but not as well understood even in 2020 as maybe it should be. You can have sort of large droplets, like the kind that you cough or sneeze out. And those are the things that masks, even a crummy cloth mask is designed to block some of the transfer of those, that 6 foot rule of distance is because those large particles that have virus in them, they spew outward, but they also are affected by gravity and they fall down. They're also what are the transmission from surfaces. The reason we were told wash your hands a lot or or disinfect surfaces. Those surfaces, if they're going to transfer a virus, are called fomites, F-O-M-I-T-E. That was a thing that people were very worried about at the beginning of the pandemic, and seem to be less so now. But then there's this other mode, these of smaller particles that people that come out of our mouths and other parts of our lungs just when we're talking. And those are the ones that kind of, they're much lighter and smaller. They float around somewhere in between, like a vapor and a gas. And those seem to be, it's looking increasingly like, and this is all really, really early science still, increasingly like those are, if you're in a room, if you're in an enclosed space for a long period of time with somebody who's infected, that's what gets passed around. That's how people are picking up the disease more, much more of an issue. Potentially, again, this is all preliminary science still, much more an issue indoors than outdoors. It's one of the reasons people are hopeful that having restaurants or businesses outside and opening up streets to people so they can walk on them instead of just using them for cars is less of a risk. Also, I think probably there's some differences in understanding risk. One of the hypotheses for why Japan has been pretty successful in managing its outbreak, its part of the pandemic, without the kind of serious lockdown measures or lockdown-ish measures like we've had in the United States, is that they were very careful at communicating the risks of having long conversations with people in enclosed spaces or being in crowds, and saying there were different levels of risk here, but not telling people they weren't allowed to do any of it, not taking what you might call an abstinence approach that we have here, which in other public health circumstances, I think we can probably agree, abstinence approaches tend not to be as successful as those that try to mitigate risk more. So that may be going on as well. Again, I don't want to be out there saying these things are all true or all for sure. The science is still happening. It's happening right now while we're talking.
Have you looked at other countries and how their modeling differs from the U.S.? You've mentioned the U.K. Are there things we could learn from the way these calculations are made elsewhere?
Well, very much so. But part of the way that a few countries have been very successful in dealing with the pandemic, and that has waxed and waned as those countries have dealt with different versions of this. But one way to not have to deal with the economic consequences is to get in front of a pandemic before it spreads as widely as it has here in the United States. You know, we're in this situation because we didn't do the things at the top. I say we, like it was you and I, because the public health officials in charge of these things didn't do the stuff at the top that a place like Singapore or Hong Kong or Taiwan or South Korea did. All of those are places that, because they, for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that they had much more direct experience with SARS, with another coronavirus that killed people, is that they had all of these systems in place to test people as they came into the country, to test people widely as they started to get sick and trace the clusters that they were exposed to give them places to be if they had to quarantine or be separate from people so they wouldn't infect others, and got very aggressively out in front of the disease so that they didn't have the same scale of problem that that the United States has had. Now, some of those places have also now dealt with second waves because they missed certain things. In Singapore, for example, they had very small numbers of infections until COVID-19 got into dormitories in which they house foreign workers, thousands and thousands of people who live in those. And once they were in those close quarters, those congregate living situations, they had the same thing, that very much like was happening in the United States in homes that care for elderly people, or in close quarters, meatpacking plants, for example, where they were up to, last I looked, 17,000 cases. So, you know, it's possible to miss things. But what you're trying to do is once you have the disease is spread slowed, you get that reproductive number low, then you can start to do things like testing, like contact tracing, like giving people places to isolate, that mean that you don't have the economic consequences because you've done this other work. So you don't have to model, is it worth trillions of dollars? Because you've spent millions, potentially billions, on the infrastructure to prevent that in the first place.
Ironically, you note that models look as if they have failed and been inaccurate if their predictions cause people to change their behavior to the extent that they prevent the worst outcomes.
It is a bummer for modelers. if they stand at the top of the walls saying, you know, don't, if you're, that if there's a scene in the science fiction movie Alien where Ripley, Sigourney Weaver, says, don't let the guy with the alien face hugger on his face back onto the spaceship. We have to follow quarantine procedures. And the rest of her crew says, we've got to let him on. He's going to die. And they don't listen to Ripley, you know. And Ripley's the one who has to fight the aliens for a bunch of movies after that. But she says, you know, we can't break quarantine. But the thing about that is that, like, if they had listened to Ripley, then there wouldn't be a movie. There just wouldn't have been an alien on the Nostromo. Everybody would have been okay. The poor guy. I think it was Dallas. I can't remember. The poor guy would have died, but the alien wouldn't have killed everybody else. And it would have seemed like she had overreacted.
Well, yeah. And I was going to ask you if it can work the other way. Presumably it can. If early underestimates prevent people from taking precautions, then is that what we're really looking at here in the United States?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. You know, one of the things in the basic rule book for dealing with public health emergencies is that you're not supposed to, it's supposed to be more than bipartisan. It's supposed to be omnipartisan. There's not supposed to be any political question about what happens. The public health folks are supposed to present a united front. And that hasn't happened here. And so what's happened is that people's political allegiances have led them to take given postures on how to respond. So very early on, when the pandemic first started, when the disease was first coming to the United States, there were some politicians, including the president, who downplayed the severity of it for reasons that I suppose you and I could argue about it. But it did make it seem like if your allegiance was to one particular side of the political equation, the rhetorical equation in this country, that you had to believe this wasn't serious. And now there's even people who, there was a controversial study out of Stanford, for example, that tried to make that science stick. That's definitely not what science or public health is supposed to do. But yes, there is a strain of politics and what I think, as a personal opinion, economically driven approach that needs the disease to not seem as serious as it is, which has as an outcome people arguing that in fact the death count is too high, that in fact that 100,000 Americans dead is some sort of fake news, and that's to me is a tragedy. It's a terrifying tragedy.
What's interesting about the politicization of this is that the money that we've spent, the trillions that we've spent trying to recover from this, health-wise and economically both, surely is higher than the early cost would have been of taking action before the infection took hold around the country.
It's very easy to say if you instead of cutting tens, hundreds of millions of dollars out of public health efforts around the country, as the United States has and as states have had to do as budgets get tighter, if that had all been maintained, then we wouldn't be in the situation we are now. And I think that is, for me, I'm a little bit out on a limb saying this, but for me, that's manifestly true. But in times when there's not a pandemic, it's very easy to cut the amount of money you're spending on pandemics because people start to sound, it's easy to start to see them as being kind of wide-eyed. You're out there raving about some sort of, you're telling me that some kind of disease that nobody's ever seen is going to come out of a bat and somehow infect animals and probably out of China because that's where they came from before and spread worldwide. And then that hasn't happened in a century. They say, look what happened last time. SARS and MERS both kind of weren't anywhere near as serious as you were saying. You're crying wolf again. We're not going to put up fences around the sheep. And you know, here we are. And like all these people are now saying, I told you there were wolves coming. And maybe that means that we move in a different direction in terms of what we fund and our public health priorities and our medical priorities and our basic research scientific priorities. I hope that's true. But of course, I'm a science reporter, and so I'm into that sort of stuff. I feel like that would have been a non-controversial, or at least a scientifically perhaps controversial opinion, but not a politically one in times past. And that has become, for a lot of different reasons, a politically controversial opinion. It's politically controversial to suggest that a cloth mask might help a little bit in keeping people who are asymptomatic but infected unknowingly transmitting it to other people. That seems to me to be fairly non-controversial. And I will say, even in my own office, the science desk, just within the science desk, we've had fights about how useful masks are. It's a scientifically interesting question. But as soon as epidemiologists say, well, look, we think it might help some, and at this point we need everything to help some because we don't have a good drug and we don't have a good vaccine, I find that non-controversial. It is controversial for reasons that go well beyond what an epidemiologic model or the case studies of various COVID-19 clusters have found.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It makes me think, Adam, about the fact that we are still, you know, like we're not quite using our lizard brains, but as humans, we're still best at responding to threats and situations that we observe with our own senses. When you have something that is for many people, quite fortunately, kind of a theoretical threat because they don't see someone next to them coughing. You know, I think we would all take precautions if we had the sense that someone in the room was actively ill. Sometimes, I mean, there's all kinds of human psychology that plays into, do you feel foolish in a mask? And I'll just go on the record and say that I'm a mask wearer in public these days, especially indoors. But people sometimes wonder if they're overdoing things and if they are making too much of something.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I guess I think a couple of things about that. I think that I wrote a story a couple of months ago, trying to do some of the math on it, if, as you say, if it is the case that until something is a direct threat or directly recognizable risk that we have personal experience of, it seems remote to us, how many people would have to die in the United States before all of us knew someone who died of COVID-19? And there are a lot of different ways to do this math. It's actually pretty complicated network theory involving the way social networks like Facebook and Twitter work and a whole bunch of other fun economic assumptions. But depending on how you do that math, it can be, I think the lowest that number got was something like 500,000 people, which thankfully we're not close to yet. Unfortunately, we're 20% of. And so that means that there are large parts of the country where this feels like something that only happened in New York, right? Or only happened in Washington, which on the one hand belies a kind of astonishing lack of empathy in a weird way, but also let's say, as you say, it's sort of a lizard brain like thing where if it is out of sight, then it is out of mind. But I also think, the social, the feelings that we have about whether we look foolish in a mask or whether the one that I have a lot of trouble figuring out is that it looks unmanly somehow. I had this joke about toxic masculinity, right? with a K. Of like, well, that happens because there are enough leaders who are charismatic enough and trusted enough who are also evincing those opinions. And in a public health crisis, what you do hope for is unity among the people who are both fighting the public health crisis and the people who are in political leadership who let that happen. And that's not happening now. You see schisms. Talk about something non-controversial. I think it's non-controversial to say there are schisms even in the people at the podium in a given briefing from the White House or the executive branch of who thinks what about the what works here and what doesn't and what's important. And with absent those kind of signals from people who we trust, then it's very easy for other people to step into that breach and convey those signals.
Adam Rogers is senior correspondent at Wired, where you can read his article, How Much is a Human Life Actually Worth? Adam, once again, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I hope it was helpful.
It sure
was. I hope everyone's okay.
Yeah. You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. You can subscribe to our podcast using any podcast app. Just do a search for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.